when you have a data set of 10,000 images, it's not copying them. It's getting inspired by them. The same way if I went to a museum, looked at every painting in there, and then went home and I was like, I'm going to paint something in a similar style to some of these. Nobody would really have an issue with that because I was just inspired, and you're allowed to be inspired by people.
That was August Rosedale. August is the creator of Mirage Gallery. Now, Mirage Gallery is different than a typical gallery in that they create and represent AI artists, meaning these artists are 100% computer generated. And when I say 100%, I mean everything, from their profile image of their face to their biography and, of course, their artwork. I wanted to have August on the show for a couple of reasons. First, his AI artists are just creating beautiful works of art. And as you'll hear on the show, they're completely sold out. But second, this is something that anyone can play with. We discuss how his art is created using a class of machine learning called GAN, which stands for Generative Adversarial Network. These are all open source tools that you can download to create your own AI art. It was great to have August on. He's certainly an up-and-coming entrepreneur to keep on your radar. With that, this is August Rosedale. August, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you on the show. I'm really excited to get into everything that you've been dabbling with and experimenting on, because I think it's a really wild time to be at the intersection of AI and art, and it seems like you're just in the thick of it.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. It's just been such a crazy past, I don't even know how many months, but so much has been happening in the AI space and the NFT space, of course. So it's been crazy.
Yeah. I'd love to start off by just covering kind of your background. Are you graduated from college now, or where are you on that front?
So I'm actually going into my senior year of college. I go to school in Santa Clara and I'm studying mechanical engineering. So almost done with that.
Cool. And so what mechanical engineering and AI, is there overlap there? Like, is that a class that you took in school, or what got you? Because I think of mechanical engineering being something very technical and something that I wouldn't necessarily think someone that's interested in art would be on that side of the house.
Like, yeah.
How did that happen?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's kind of funny because, yeah, they're super different. And like, ever since I've been growing up, I've always loved building and taking things apart and just understanding how everything works and all that. So I think that side of me was what made me decide to want to do mechanical engineering, because I've always liked building. Then I've also had this kind of entrepreneurial side. But I think in high school, I was thinking that I kind of figured my path would end up being building a product, a physical product, and then having that be like the company I start or something, compared to just like being an engineer for a company. I've always been more focused at wanting to do my own thing. And I kind of think I thought I was going to focus on hardware, because in high school, I built this product that I thought I was going to go forward with and things like that. But then once I got to high school, I kind of started figuring out like, well, yeah, hardware stuff is cool, but it can also be super expensive to test and prototype, and you have to deal with manufacturing and all of that. So then I started focusing on stuff that I could do on my computer, which is then how I ended up starting playing with all this AI stuff and then sticking to that. But I kind of have made it so far with mechanical engineering, and I do really like the area. So I'm just sticking with it. And I'll kind of have this, it'll kind of just give me this like different side of things that's, I think, not as common of to combine like NFT AI space and also has a degree in mechanical engineering. It's kind of just this cool, like how different they are.
Yeah. And I mean, if you ever wanted to do anything in the hardware space that was applicable, you'd have the skill set to do so. I'm curious, like when you first started getting into the AI and art side, where were you? How old were you? What made you decide? I mean, were NFTs even a thing? Or were you just like, I want to play around with AI and see if it can make cool art? Like what did you hear about what new technology dropped where you said, okay, this is now something I can do on my own?
Yeah. I think so. Pretty much it actually wasn't that long ago when I started playing with AI stuff. It was during COVID for sure, but I was kind of the things I was first doing that I got into was just looking at how to create deepfakes, because I saw that tech and I was like, wow, like this is just completely insane that there's even tech that you can create something like this. And I was playing with that, but I think what ended up happening for me was I was like, okay, this is super crazy tech that this can be done. But when I was looking at deepfakes, I was kind of thinking, there are so many more bad outcomes that I can see with like practical implications of deepfakes. I was like, it just seems like it's always manipulating or something that you don't really want to be a part of compared to like potential helpful outcomes with deepfakes. So I was kind of like, okay, I think I should steer from this, even though this was all this good experience and just starting with doing stuff with AI. But then I was kind of wanting to start playing with other sorts of AI, which was then about the same time that me and my friend got access to GPT-3 from OpenAI, which is that text completion model, and started chatting with that. And then that was very eye-opening to us. Like, this is a new time, and this is pretty crazy.
Yeah, so when I'm in the same boat. When I first started playing around with GPT-3, I was like, oh, crap, like AI has finally arrived. Like, it felt like for the first time, it was shockingly good. Like the stuff that you had seen on the AI side prior to that was great in that there were some demos, but this felt like a leap forward. And was there anything, so you mentioned the text completion, and that was really cool. But what was it? Where was the art side? Like they were was it something where you had to go outside of OpenAI to? Okay, so what did you find? Was this something you were coding yourself? Like what? So where did you find the right tools to even begin on the art side?
Yeah, so pretty much everything I've done with the art side of things has been open source code that I found, and pretty much I saw people creating this AI art, which are created with these generative adversarial networks. And I saw these art pieces, and I saw this was also before the NFT explosion happened. And I saw this one company that was selling physical prints, and there was no NFT aspect. It was just, you can buy a physical canvas print for your house and it's AI art. And I saw that and I was like, wow, this is crazy. I want to figure out how they're doing this. But then the one thing I thought of with it, and I started playing with it, and I found open source code to pretty much train your own model. So all the models that I've trained, I've put together the data sets in order to have something that no one else has done. Because there are some sites that you can go on that will have data sets that other people have put together. But the thing is, like, yeah, that can be good practice if you're just trying to get a feel for like how to train one of these models. But you're not going to get something very unique, because chances are, if it's a public data set, so many people have trained on that. So I started figuring out, okay, I want to put together my own data sets. I have to figure out how to format them, all of that, and then do the training and do that on cloud computers in order to just have good GPU power. But then a lot of the AI art that I saw people doing, I was always thinking that seemed like it was lacking, like having more of a story behind it. Because I've always felt like a big part of art and buying art and why some art from famous artists sells for so much is because yeah, you're getting the piece of art, but you're also, you also have the story with the artist, and maybe they gave a story for what they were thinking when they made the piece, or that they have this cool life story that is kind of shown in the art. And I think that's very meaningful to people. So I was thinking, okay, this AI art is cool, but I think it's really in the long run gonna need that side of things to hold value, because at the beginning, obviously it has value just because it's AI art. No one's seen that and that's super cool. I think the first piece of AI art, I think maybe it was in 2017, it sold for like $430,000 or something. Mm-hmm. And that was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense because it's like the first piece created by this sort of network. But for going forward, it's not always gonna, if everyone else starts just creating art, there needs to be something that stands out, just like any human art. And I kind of was thinking, okay, I want to create these AI artists that create art, that have their own stories, and they have headshots that, and they have Twitter accounts, and everything's created with AI. Was kind of the first idea that I was going with before I was looking into the NFT space at all.
Hmm. So, wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
This is cool. So let's take that a little bit further before we go back to actually how you pulled this off. But so what you said is like, okay, I'm going to make fake artists, AR artists, that, how do you train an AI artist to be different? I mean, is it just the designation that you're calling them a name and giving them a name, or you actually give them different tastes? Like, do you, right, like, is it, because in some sense you could say, okay, my artist name is Jeff, and I'm going to give Jeff 100,000 images and basically generate new stuff, new landscapes. And Jeff's really into landscapes and really likes the outdoors, and that's going to be anything that Jeff creates, right? But mm-hmm. That's like all the deeper you get with that artist in terms of it's just a data set and you just giving it a marketing name, right?
So there's also this one other aspect, which is going back to OpenAI and GPT-3 and actually pretty much combining, using GPT-3 as the personality and like anything with textual output, and then having that side of the artist, and then having, yeah, the actual art creating side. And pretty much, yeah, for the art creating side, the only inputs that it has are the data set that I put together. So pretty much, if you want an artist that specializes in a specific style of art, all you need to do is that data set needs to just be heavily just concentrated of that style, and then the output will look similar. But then I think going one step further was, okay, now how do we also incorporate GPT-3 into this so that they can actually tweet about their feelings and about the art pieces? And we can go into how they talk about pieces that, if you think about it, GPT-3 hasn't seen the pieces, but, and then people can actually talk to them. And Alejandro is the name of one of these first artists that I created. And he's actually had two people do email interviews with him. So, and that side of things is entirely GPT-3. So it's kind of just been this fun combining of these different AI architectures.
Crazy. So when you look at Alejandro on the website, I see a picture of a man, mm-hmm. and this could be a video walking down the street. Is this 100% generated?
Yeah, yeah. So pretty
that
much
face is not real.
Yes, exactly. And the faces would always freaks people out, because the faces, if anyone looks at the site, the faces look very much like actual photographs. And how that happens is, I actually was first inspired by, there's this site called thispersondoesnotexist.com, and they're doing the same thing. And pretty much all it is it's the same type of neural net that creates the art. The only difference is that the data set, instead of being tons of these pieces of art or photographs of these, of the ocean or whatever, it's a data set specifically on photos of human faces, right? Mm. Because the cool thing is, some of the art pieces from these models I've done, is they look like paintings, right? They look like the texture looks like a painting, but
yeah, that's beautiful.
Thank you. But that's only because the data set has actual paintings. So there's nothing stopping these AI models from having the outputs actually look like photographs, and that's shown with the faces and looking at, yes, sites like This Person Does Not Exist, because they just trained entirely on photographs, right? So then you train that for enough time and the outputs become quite convincing, but every output, while it's trying to look similar to the things in the input data set, it's not any of them, meaning any right. face that comes out of a model like that is not an actual person.
Right. Yeah. It's so cool. Cause this is to the level of, and I'm sure people have seen this online over the last couple of years, but it is one of those types of photos where you look at it and there would be no way to tell whether it's a human or not. Like you would believe it to be a human. I'm curious, when someone does a interview with Alejandro over email or over text, how do you train that data set to understand what, because you have Taylor and Alejandro, the two, he or she or them mm-hmm. or whatever you want, however you want to designate yeah, exactly. them. How do you train them to respond in a way that is applicable to their art? Like right. how do they know what they've created?
Yes. So pretty much OpenAI's GPT-3, the main thing that you do, because pretty much when you're talking to GPT-3, you're just getting access to this huge model that OpenAI spent millions on the actual computing to train. And all you're paying for is access to it. But the cool thing is it's a pre-trained model. So it's different from the art stuff where for the art piece and the faces, I'm training the model, right? For GPT-3, it's a pre-trained model that I'm pretty much just playing with, but I can give it these prompts. And that's the whole thing with GPT-3 is coming up with good prompts that'll have it output what you're hoping it can output, because GPT-3 can be applied in many different scenarios. So pretty much for one of these artists, what I would do is I'd give it very basic summary that I need to give it in order for it to kind of take it from there and expand. So for one of the artists like Alejandro, I don't remember, I don't have the prompt up, but say something like, this is an AI artist named Alejandro. Alejandro specializes in landscape paintings and blah, blah, blah. And then just a very short bit there. And then you give it that. And then you can pretty much say like, this is a conversation between an interviewer and Alejandro. And then I can enter text then as the interviewer, and it'll just take it from there. And that's what GPT-3 is very good at
doing.
That's
insane. How convincing is the conversation?
They're very convincing. I mean, that's why I knew I wanted to do something with GPT-3, because when I was first playing with that, I was like, wow, like there has never been something like this. Like there's always been these like AI chatbots and stuff, but they're always not that good. And GPT-3, in my opinion, was the first one that I've ever talked to where I was like, this is actually insane.
Yeah, I agree. And in the limited demos that I've had with it, it's been very impressive. I'm curious, going back to the actual art, let's just take Alejandro, for example, and people can obviously follow along on the show notes, and I'll have all the links to all these things. But when you're looking at the various different landscapes, and some of them are ships out at sea, mm-hmm. others are a lake kind of atmosphere, another one's kind of like this fading beauty one is kind of like a sketch in black and white. Mm-hmm. Are these all different data sets, or is it one data set and then you asking for a different output? How does that work?
So pretty much each artist, so Alejandro and Taylor, they each have their own data set. So every piece by the same artist is the same data set. And yeah, you'll see things like you were saying, yeah, fading beauty, that one's pretty cool. And it looks very different from some of the others. And why that is just because of the variety in the input data set. So pretty much these models, you train them on this very large data set, normally about 10,000 images or so. And then you let it train for however much time you choose. Higher amounts of time tends to get results that'll end up kind of making more sense. And that's also kind of a subjective thing.
Yeah.
If you think that looks cooler or not as cool, it's totally subjective.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, let's say, for example, okay, so I take it, and I do want to get into actually how you do this on the compute side, but mm-hmm. let's say you go and you rent out, I'm assuming you're renting out like Amazon GPU boxes. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So you got some Amazon GPU boxes. And so these are graphics cards that are, their sole purpose is to churn on this, compute and calculate and get trained, right? So how do you know giving these models more time produces more convincible imagery? Meaning if I set something to go and I spin up these machines, are you looking at the output in real time, where like you go to bed, you wake up in the morning, you're like, okay, show me the last 10 images.
That is spot on. So pretty much these models will output like sample images every so often, and I'll just look at those, see how I think it's doing, if I want to stop the training or have it continue, because the training does add up and is pretty expensive for being on such big computers. But the funny thing is, if you do it on a smaller Amazon computer, for example, it'll end up costing the same if you get it to as far as a point in training. It'll just take longer, if you know what I mean. Like,
right,
you for the big computers that I do it on, they're way more expensive, but then they train way faster, so you end up paying the same.
I see. Okay, so again, on the output side, like mm-hmm. we had mentioned this, like Winter Silence and Fading mm-hmm. Beauty, they look very different than the others. Was that a shock to you, or is it something where you pull in the imagery, it's kicking out images, and you're like, okay, cool ship. Oh, that one has a weird looking tree. That one has, whoa, wait a second. There's a black and white one. Like, why did that happen?
Yes, I think I definitely remember seeing those and seeing ones of that style and being like, these are awesome. And that's why I included some of them in the first collection from Alejandro. So it must just be the data set. Obviously, the data set that I put together for Alejandro is over 10,000 images. So I have not looked at all of them, but I can guarantee that somewhere in there is art of that style. And that's why it gives outputs like that sometimes, because it's kind of cool with these models where sometimes they'll really morph things together, and other times it'll do a good job understanding, okay, this style is different from this style. I'm not going to combine them as much. I'm going to create individual ones that could look like either of those, and then do them as separate pieces.
Hmm. And where did you get those 10,000 images? You said you haven't looked at them all. Where do you find a training set?
Yeah, so it was a combination of combining data sets that people have shared publicly. But like I was saying, I never wanted to train on just someone else's data set, because then there are other people who have pretty much created the same model. So I'd compile lots of different data sets. I'd find images and paintings, and I've done like scraping, but it also brings up interesting questions that I've always proposed to people, which is things like there's not very much currently written from a legality standpoint of, okay, if you train this AI model on 10,000 images, and those 10,000 images, now they might be owned by a very large number of people, because of they're probably going to be images of different sorts and styles, so they end up being from different people, from photography to art, so on. So the question is, when you train an AI model on a data set like that, the outputs from the AI model are entirely unique and not not anything from the input data set. So the question just becomes, in a legal standpoint, who owns that output from the model? And I've thought it through, and there are a bunch of different options, the ways to think about it. Because one, you could say, okay, well, whoever owns the data set owns the outputs. But if the data set's owned by 10,000 people, like, does each person get 1/10,000th of the outputs? Like, that doesn't really make sense, right? So, and then you could also say, okay, well, is it the person who coded the AI algorithm that did the training? Or often, since AI has been very open source, so often the person running the model doing the training is not the one who coded it. So is it the person who put together the data set and put it in the AI model? Or is it owned really by no one? Because when you have a data set of 10,000 images, it's not copying them. It's getting inspired by them. The same way, if I went to a museum, looked at every painting in there, and then went home and I was like, I'm going to paint something in a similar style to some of these, nobody would really have an issue with that because I was just inspired, and you're allowed to be inspired by people. So you might be able to apply it in that sense where, okay, the AI is looking at this data set, but since the outputs are entirely new, you couldn't say that the owners of that data set would have ownership of the output. The same way that if I looked at the paintings and I made a painting, not many would argue that the artists of those first paintings would own my painting that I just made. You know,
I mean, it totally makes sense. The only caveat would be if the output in any way resembles the original paintings, meaning like a bit for bit kind of copy. Like,
totally.
Is there any of that going on here? Meaning, like, let's just say we take a look at one of these paintings and, okay, Tangerine Sunset over that you have here, beautiful clouds, like the fantastic. I mean, this could easily have just been painted by a human. This is a beautiful painting. Are any part of those clouds, or could they be identical to something that it saw somewhere else? Or is that just mathematically impossible?
So the way that I believe everything to work is because the data set, if it would be one thing if the data set, if every image in the data set had the exact same clouds, the outputs would have those exact clouds. So then that would be a bit more questionable. But when the data set is such a huge amount of images in different styles and pictures and of clouds and without clouds, then what ends up happening is that those outputs end up not just being like Yo said, bit for bit copies. It ends up being pretty much what the GAN does, which is, like I was saying, the generative adversarial network. All it does is it tries to create its own outputs that can trick itself into thinking, okay, this output could have plausibly been from the input data set. And it keeps doing that, and it almost plays this game with itself where one part of it is creating pictures and now a different part of it is going through outputs from that this other side of it created and looking at ones from the data set, and it's pretty much grabbing them at random and saying, is this from the input data set? And, or is this one from the output that it just created? And it pretty much keeps doing that until it's able to convince itself that the outputs it's thinking, this one's from the input data set.
Okay. So
even though it's not.
And that data is quarantined off, so it wouldn't know whether or not it's from the input side, or is that true?
Yeah. So there's this discriminator and the generator, and they're totally separate. And the generator just creates piece after piece, and the discriminator tries to figure out if the piece it is fed is from the input data set or if it came from the generator. And then it just keeps playing this game with itself like that.
Awesome. So let's talk about how this has worked out for you. So you went, you started working on this project, you created these two personas, your artist now, NFTs drop and they start becoming a thing. And did you look at that and were like, oh crap, like these could be NFTs?
Yeah. So pretty much what happened, it was kind of funny because I was thinking, okay, I need a way to authenticate these paintings because my goal, like I was saying with Alejandro and Taylor, was I was planning on just selling physical prints. And I was planning on, like I said, I saw companies that were doing physical prints, but they were pretty much just doing high quantity, sell as many as possible, but they don't have their own artists. And I was thinking, okay, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do low quantity, higher cost, and they're going to have each piece is going to be from this artist, and that's why it's going to be cooler and totally different. But I was thinking, okay, now if this got some traction, how do I make sure someone else, let's say on eBay or something, isn't able to say, hey, this is a piece from Alejandro, I'm selling it, when it's not from Alejandro? I was like, okay, how do I authenticate that? Because of course, they're prints on canvas, right? So it's not like with an actual painting where you can actually take it to someone and figure out, was this painted by the original person or is this a fake? It's harder when everything starts on a computer and gets printed on the canvas, right? So I was kind of thinking, okay, how do I authenticate that these pieces are actually from the artist that I've created? And I was thinking, okay, blockchain is perfect for things like that. And I was planning on, okay, I'm going to take a hash of the image, like store that on chain and then have that be given somehow to the buyer. And I started looking into that stuff and I find out non-fungible token. And I'm like, okay, this seems to make perfect sense. This, I can pretty much do this. It'll be even easier than I thought to do it because there's been plenty of people who have been doing this, and I can pretty much send the token also to the person who bought the physical. But at the time, I was still thinking that aspect of things will be this technical side that people don't really care as much about. That's just the technical authentication side, the values in the physical print. But because I was thinking like that, because this was before everything blew up. So, and then, yeah, then as I'm just setting all this up, NFTs started really picking up traction at the beginning.
And then what happened with your first release? Like, did you release them all at once? Did they gradually sell out over time? Because I know when I go to your website, like they're sold out.
Yes. So that's a pretty good story. So what happened is, okay, let me think. So I pretty much was working on them and trying to figure out the different aspects I want for how I want this to work with when pieces are sold, how many pieces. And what I decided on was each artist will have 100 pieces, and those pieces will be one of one pieces, and they're going to release them in collections of 20 or so. And then as for each next collection will be with a further trained model from that artist. So it actually seems like their work is they're learning over time. And what I was doing was I was connected, or I was doing a lot of talking on Clubhouse, and I ended up, and then I was doing a LinkedIn post, and I ended up working on getting this event set up. It was this event with Signum Growth Capital and ARK Invest, and they were trying to plan this like metaverse type event. And I was in contact with Angela, who is from Signum Growth Capital, and she saw my project and pretty much wanted me to have the release happen at this event. And then I ended up kind of working with her the entire time on getting everything set up and other artists attending, and Kathy Wood from ARK Invest was speaking, and I was speaking, and a bunch of other people. And it was just a really awesome experience to also meet all these crazy people. But the whole plan was that event ended up, it got pushed a few times, but it ended up happening in May. And that was when I was going to do the first 20 pieces from each of the artists would go for auction. And when that happened, the timing ended up being not ideal. And the event happened right when that big crypto crash was happening. And I think that was one of the aspects. And then I think the audience of people weren't quite ideal for people who were looking to buy NFTs. So the event was fun and meeting everyone was awesome, but it didn't sell very many pieces. I think out of the 40 pieces that were listed for auction, I think probably 5 to 10 of them had bids and sold. And then pretty much I said that if any piece sold for over one Ethereum, I'd include a physical print. So that was how I tied back to the physicals. And I think there were two or three that had physical prints included. But then there were 22. For a very long time, I was slowly selling the others, and I had them all fixed price after the auction. And I started with them at one Ethereum so that it would include the physicals. But then it seemed people really didn't care as much about the physicals as I thought people would. Because for me, I always wanted a physical. I was like, I want this up in my house. But the remaining pieces ended up, the price got set to 0.25 ETH. And over the course of a few months, they'd sell every now and then. And I kept promoting and I kept tweeting, or JPT3 kept tweeting from all for Alejandro and Taylor. And then I start working on this new project, which then led to the sellout happening of Alejandro and Taylor. And in the future, I'm planning on doing future collections with them. Like I was saying, each of them are going to have 100, and currently they're each sold out, but they've also only each sold their first 20.
Crazy. So what does it cost you to mint one of these? Like, what is it, not to mint, but to actually produce one? Like, I know you have to pay for the actual server time and the GPU and all that. So for you to actually find one that you're like, ah, there's the one that I want to turn into something. Because these are pretty high res images as well, right?
So yeah, for resolution, if we talk about that, pretty much the outputs are 1024 by 1024. And then what I did for Alejandro and Taylor is that owners of the pieces could go through my site, connect their MetaMask, and then download unlockable content, which is the full-size image. But the full-size image is one that I upsized with a different sort of AI tech, because the outputs from the model are 1024 by 1024. But then I would use this AI upsizing to upscale them to 8,000 by 8,000. And that was also how I was able to print them out on canvas and have it look good.
That is awesome. And in terms of like GPU time,
right?
And all
Yeah. So for GPU time, it's quite expensive. One of the cool things, though, is that once you have your model trained, that model can output an infinite number of pieces with not very powerful computers. For example, you could do it on Google Colab, on a free Colab computer, can output maybe 2 pieces per second from one of these models that's already been trained. And it can output like 2 pieces per second forever. So each model, once you're done training it, has an infinite number of outputs that can be created with not much compute power. But the training itself is what's GPU intensive. So the way I would do it is I would do it on these Amazon machines that each, or the machine would have 8 NVIDIA Tesla V100 GPUs, and it would have 8 of those. And it's kind of crazy that we're even in a time where you just have access to that, because each of those GPUs, if you bought one, I believe they're $12,000 a piece or so just for the GPUs. So that'd be
crazy,
like over 100,000 in just GPUs if you were trying to do something like this at home. But for that same computer with Amazon, it's $24 an hour. So it becomes affordable. And to get a model that is good enough, I normally would spend a few thousand dollars on training. I've seen people who really do white papers on these sort of models. They'll train about twice as far, a little bit more than twice as long as I did, and they'll spend about $8,000 or $9,000 if they were doing it on those same sort of computers. So it's expensive, but the cool part is that once you have that, like I was saying, it can just output pieces forever for free if you do it on somewhere like Google Colab.
It's so awesome. Very cool. I'd love to get into, well, actually, now that we're here, let's just go a little bit further, and then I'd love to get into your next project that you're working on. But since we're talking about some of the technical stuff and how to create this, what if you were, you know, someone at home? I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are listening to this and saying, this sounds awesome. Like, I want to play. I want the open source software. I can get some photos. Maybe I can take my own photos and add it to a model. How would someone get started? Like, what is the open source software that you use? How complicated is it to get it set up? And yeah, just what does that process look like?
Yeah, so it kind of is one of those things where end up just getting the hang of how to do things like from GitHub, right? So everything that I've done, I've played with many different sorts of AI models that are open source on GitHub. And while they are there and they're accessible, you still need a certain amount of technical chops to actually run it, because you often have these classic things where you need to figure out all the different things you need to install in the different versions and libraries, which are every time you do a project like this from a GitHub repo, it can be a pain. Yeah. But that's one of those things where if you just sit down and you're doing everything through the command line, right? So it's all through the terminal. So it's not like it has some pretty interface where you're just dragging in your data set and then clicking train. You know,
you need a little bit of like Unix chops kind of going on here. Yes,
exactly. So I did everything on a Ubuntu machines. But the thing is that I've seen new software coming out that's really making it easier for people to do it in a way where there is more GUI with an interface for people to actually do these things with. I'm blanking on the name, but there was a platform I saw where you could actually train these sort of models, and they have an interface for it. So you can do it with very little technical knowledge of how to do things through the terminal. But I don't know what that company's pricing model is. I'm sure you're paying for that. So where if you do it through GitHub, all you end up paying for is if you're doing it on these big computers, you're paying for those, but you can try things out. What I would always do is start on a really small computer. It should have one GPU and you'll want like CUDA installed. So for a GPU, for the NVIDIA GPU, but do it on a machine with one GPU instead of eight GPUs, right? Because at the beginning, you end up wasting lots of time just fixing errors, installing everything, figuring out. It takes a while before you get something that you can actually train. So I would always start on cheaper computers, figure it all out. Then once I felt confident, I'd save a snapshot of that computer, and then I'd take that snapshot and launch a new instance that would be maybe the 8 GPU one. So then it's all set up. So then I can pretty much start it up and start training and not be spending 24 an hour figuring out how to fix some bug, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So you just like do the inexpensive and the snapshot will allow you to get up and running pretty quickly. Once you move to the more pricier hardware. But on the actual software that you're using, are you using NVIDIA software that does the GAN, or what did you find there package wise?
So for the stuff with GANs that I've done, I've pretty much always played with StyleGAN from NVIDIA. And I'm not sure exactly what the question you just said, but yeah, I've done it with StyleGAN.
Okay, StyleGAN. So for people that are actually looking for the specific software to start playing around with at the command line, let's say they do have a little bit of like Unix, Linux chops, then StyleGAN is the one to download and clone and start
Playing with. It's called StyleGAN 2, and it's a very fun time. You pretty much all you have to figure out is get everything installed, get a virtual environment set up, or I normally do it with Anaconda. I get a Conda environment, get it all set up, get everything installed, then figure out your data set. And the first times I did it, just go to a site like Kaggle and get one of their data sets that someone made and just train on that one. Because
what is Kaggle? I'm not familiar with that.
Kaggle is this site that has lots of just data sets on lots of different things. And they have an API, so you can actually download the data set straight to your instance if you get an API key. And get that figured out. And then pretty much there have been people on there who will make data sets that are properly formatted to do training like this. So then you can practice training without having to make sure you understand the data set stuff and make, because the data sets need to be formatted in a particular way in order for it to not fail. So it can be helpful to get a data set that you know is good and that you can just start on. And then see if you can get it actually training and get some outputs. And then once you see some outputs, then you're like, okay, now I'm going to play with this and now I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it again. And I'm going to do it with my own data set. Because also I know Google Cloud Computing and Amazon, they both have accessible ways to get credits when you sign. I know Google, I'm pretty sure you get $300 in credits just on signing up. Amazon, you can apply to the Activate Founders program without anything, and you can get like $1,000. So stuff like that is perfect to just start figuring stuff out and not stress about spending all of your money on cloud computers.
Yeah, awesome. So let's talk about the next project that you're toying around with, this crypto. I noticed when I clicked the drop down on your site under artists, we've already talked about Taylor and Alejandro, but you have one called Crypto Native. Mm-hmm. What is this?
Yes. So this is a whole new big thing I've been doing that picked up a whole bunch more traction than Alejandro and Taylor, and also led to Alejandro and Taylor having all of their stuff get bought up within a few minutes. So pretty much the idea was, okay, this is the project that now that I've been seeing the NFT space and been meeting all these great people and talking on Twitter spaces and talking on Clubhouse, you just meet all these people and you start to understand, okay, NFT, what should I do in the NFT space that's actually taking advantage of the tech? And Alejandro and Taylor were not doing that, because the whole idea with them, like I said, I created them and came up with their idea before I knew about NFTs. So the plan was just to do those physical prints. So there's nothing dynamic that's going to happen with a physical canvas print. So I was never thinking like that. So with Crypto Native, I was thinking, okay, how can I do something cooler that is taking advantage of this awesome tech and couldn't be done in a more traditional art sense. And I was thinking about ideas, and I knew I still wanted to do stuff with these AI art models, because I've just been having such a fun time and I've really gotten the hang of training models and just like putting the data set together, creating these files and then starting the training. So I was kind of thinking, okay, I definitely want to keep doing stuff with this and do a new data set also and a new style of art. So what I decided on was, okay, I'm going to have this crypto native artist, which is supposed to be targeted more at the NFT space and what I think people will find cool in the space and what I find fun to do also. And what I came up with was having these pieces that actually evolve on the secondary market. So it's having these dynamic aspects added in. And the way I was thinking I would do that is I knew from the beginning with these AI models that you can continue to train them and you can save the models at different points in training. The same way I said how Alejandro and Taylor for future collections will be with a higher trained model. But the difference is with Alejandro and Taylor, it's going to be a higher trained model with entirely new outputs. So the idea with crypto native is that, okay, I'm going to have all these different models that each represent a different amount of time trained. And I'm going to have each of those output the same image. And what ends up happening is really cool to see. What ends up happening is you have very similar looking pieces because it's the same piece from the same data set, but it's been trained for a different amount of time. So what ends up happening is it seems like you get to watch the piece evolve. And then I was like, okay, I want to do something dynamic where something causes the pieces to evolve and the metadata of the NFT to update. And what I came up with that I thought would be fun is, okay, OpenSea has an API, and with their API, you can look at things like when a sale happens of a token from a specific contract, how much that sale was for, who it was from, who it went to, plenty of things like that. And what I thought would be fun would be, okay, let's have these pieces evolve to a next phase when a sale happens that meets certain requirements. And the requirements I decided on was, okay, each piece is going to have 10 phases. After the 10 phase, it's going to stop evolving. And the requirements for the sale are, so when the mint happened, right, all the pieces start at their first phase. And when you sell them, if the sale is for a minimum of 0.2 Ethereum, that'll trigger it to switch from phase one to phase two. And then the piece will update on OpenSea and you'll get to see your evolved piece, which is just a fun idea. And then for taking that further, I was like, okay, now for future sales, I wanted to make sure it wasn't easy for people to kind of game the system and just have them evolve very easily, which is why I first of all set the minimum to 0.2 for to trigger the piece to evolve. But then also for each next phase change, the sale has to be 20% higher than any previous highest sale of that piece. So then that causes to where, for example, if there is a piece that sold for a lot more than 0.2, like let's say someone has their phase one piece and they sell it to somebody for one Ethereum. Now that new person who gets it, it's going to evolve to phase two because one Ethereum is higher than 0.2, obviously. But now what that changes is now if to get it to phase three, you need to spend this next sale needs to be 20% higher than the highest previous sale of that piece. So the next, if you're getting it to phase three, the sale would at minimum have to be 1.2 Ethereum.
So one question there to unpack that a little bit is if when you a sale takes place, you hit you see it via the API or you're pulling the API or whatever, and you see that something has happened. Where does the next image come from? Is it already been kind of predetermined, or do you then go and do the continual training to eventually produce the next piece? Or have you already trained all 10 outputs? And then what if the person that bought it likes that version that they just bought and then it quickly changes on them? Like how, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah. Okay. So to answer, okay, let's see. I'll go over the first question first. Pretty much the way we decided to do it was to have them pre-generated. And at the beginning, I was kind of thinking, okay, I want to do something entirely on-chain. But I, from a practical point, it became very difficult because of the size of these AI models. And if I had, so each of the models is about 330 megabytes. And if you think about it, there's three different styles. So that's three models. And then each of the styles has 10 phases, meaning there are 30 models that comprise of this whole collection of pieces because there are 1,000 pieces. So there are 30 models, each at 330 megabytes. Obviously, that can't be kept on chain, way too big. So because of that, we could have tried to do something where we're triggering the generation of the piece off chain with the transfer. But we thought from a practical standpoint for this first project, this first dynamic project, I kind of was like, okay, let's just do it, pre-generate the 10 phases. And then what happens on the sale is that, yeah, we're pulling the API and we're seeing the sale. And then if it fits the requirements, all we do is look at the metadata, which again, because of this had to be hosted centrally, so we can edit the metadata and update the phase number and update the image link and then unlock that image link. So there's no way to cheat and look at the future phases before the sale happens. And that was kind of the way that ended up being decided on for what made sense for a practical standpoint for this project. But I also know in the future, I would love to do a dynamic project that's entirely on chain, just because I think that would just be cool just for the technical aspect of just the technical complexity of that. Also, what to do if someone doesn't want the phase right to change. And kind of the way we're doing it is if the sale is for 20% higher than any previous one and at a 0.2 ETH minimum, it is going to evolve. And the only way to prevent that would be if you did a sale not on OpenSea, which I've seen some people do. And I kind of had a feeling people would do that, right? Which where they could pretty much do like an over-the-counter sale and just say, hey, send me Ethereum and I'll send you the piece. You just, of course, then have to trust the person.
Oh, that's awesome.
But August 30th was when the mint happened. So early Sunday morning, which is a day or two before the main mint was going to happen, I airdropped the first 50 after I deployed the contract. Spent a couple $1,000s on gas deploying the contract and sending out those airdrops. But like a little bit after that happened, yeah, the remaining 22 pieces from Alejandro and Taylor all got bought by a group of people, just bought all of them for 0.25 ETH per piece. So that was very exciting. And then I was sharing it with people. OpenSea helped promote this specific auction I did with them, because I was working with OpenSea and they were great with helping with ideas, and then also helping if there are any issues with their API. But then the mint was Monday morning at 9 a.m. And yeah, I was sharing it out the weekend before, and it was just people were looking at it and sharing it, and people seemed excited, and people started DMing me and being like, hey, I'm really like, what time does this open? Like, I'm really stressed. I'm not going to get one. And I was kind of, there were 920 pieces that were going to be available to be minted, and for 0.025 ETH per piece. And I was kind of like, you'll get one. Like I was not really thinking it was going to sell so quickly. My goal was I was going to have the mint be open for 3 days. And after the 3 days, I was going to close the mint and not allow any other pieces to be minted, and none of those remaining ones would be seen. That was my plan, and I had that all incorporated in my smart contract and everything. But so yeah, people start stressing that they're not going to get pieces, and I'm like, wow, like this is strange. Like people really are stressing about this. And then yeah, I start the mint on Monday morning, and everything was minted in like 5 minutes. All 920.
Wow, that's insane.
And I was just like sitting at my computer like, oh my God, like I didn't even know what to say. Like I'm like in college and it's a lot of money. And I haven't done that before. And it was just such a rewarding feeling also. And I started doing giveaways and stuff, and gave away a couple of Ethereum too, which was fun to be able to do after selling out like that.
Well, this is awesome. Cool. So where can people learn about, find links? Well, we'll link all this stuff up, but where can people find you on Twitter? Do you tweet personally or do you only let your AI tweet for you?
So I do have my own Twitter account. It's at AugustFR. And that's just my account. And then Mirage Gallery, which is this whole kind of overarching thing that I created that's doing all this AI stuff, has their own Twitter account too, which is just Mirage Gallery AI.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to see what you produce next, August. Great to have you on the show. Thanks for sharing all this stuff. It's really fun on a handful of levels. Like one, you got me excited about wanting to go play with this GAN stuff and install some open source software and just like throw some image sets at it. Because in some sense, there's limitless opportunity and different data sets that you can think of to potentially train on for unique and interesting outputs. Like there's a lot of blue ocean there to go after and just see what AI can produce.
Yeah,
seems like fun.
I mean, that's how I feel. We're living in a crazy time that you can actually have access to such complex tech without having like a PhD studying it. it's kind of fun.
Well, and your point about just the $100,000 worth of computer equipment for $24 an hour. It's like, yeah, go learn, play on the $4 an hour version. And then you can spin up something that would have been impossible to do just a few years ago.
So exactly. That's very cool. It's huge.
Awesome. August, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that is it for this episode. The one quick thing you can do that would be super helpful is obviously tell your friends about the show, but also head on over to proof.xyz/reviews. And there's a button there to rate the show. Giving us a review would be much appreciated because we're a brand new show. And the other thing is just a reminder, we have all the full show notes. So all the links to everything we talked about today, you can just find over at proof.xyz. Thanks for listening.